I'm here with Stephen Marsh. Stephen, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure.
So I read your I think it's your latest book, The Next Civil War, Dispatches from the American Future, with great interest. It came out in 2022, however, so I'll be interested to see if your view has darkened or not in the meantime. But before we get into the book, what is your background as a journalist and writer? What kinds of issues have you focused on, and how do you view that?
Well, all of them. I mean, basically anything that I've had a very strange career. By the time I was 30, I was a Shakespeare professor in New York, and then I became a sort of freelance writer. I was a columnist for Esquire for many years. I've written, you know, cover stories and features for The Atlantic and The New Yorker and The New York Times and pretty much everywhere else. And so, you know, in 2016, I was commissioned to write a piece for a Canadian magazine about the inauguration of Donald Trump. And that's sort of where this project began and where I really started to work on what is happening in the United States.
So your book, as you know, paints a very grim picture of the American future and also the American present. Before we jump into the book itself, how are you viewing America from Canada at this moment? I'm gathering that you guys are not eager to be the 51st state. Can you give us a Canadian's eye view of how our political landscape looks at the moment?
Well, I mean, for us, it's terrifying. Like, I mean, to me, it's sort of like your big brother shows up at the door in a meth binge with a knife asking for money. I think that would be roughly the take of the Canadian public. I mean, we've gone from basically, you know, when I was 33, there was no border with the United States. Like, you just drove across to, you know, very aggressive statements. Over half of Canadians consider the United States an enemy at this point. And we're making the most drastic possible changes to our political life because of the second Trump administration. We have to figure out new security arrangements. We have to diversify our trade in a very elaborate way. Plus, we're just going to be punched in the face by the United States. So it has altered the essence of Canadian life, I would say. I don't think it would be too much to say that at this point.
Does the 51st state talk seem serious to you on any level? I mean, I understand the tariffs are serious and the chaos and disorder provoked by much of what the second Trump administration is doing and aims to do is serious. But does the specific idea, does that just seem like any more than a troll to you?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
I mean, ask the people of Venezuela if they think it's just a troll. I mean, countries that slide into authoritarianism, which is how I see the current status of the United States, it is absolutely textbook for them to have, you know, wars with their neighbors for no good reason to prolong the authoritarian state, right? And that's a risk that we just cannot take lightly. And nobody here is taking that lightly at all.
But obviously you couldn't really prepare for it, right? I mean, if America wanted to conquer Canada, I assume that would be a fairly easy thing to do, right? I mean, in the scheme of things.
Well, I mean, yes and no. I think, you know, America's not very good at conquering places.
All right,
well, doesn't have a very good track record at actually holding on to them. Even poor countries without, you know, we have machine learning experts and petroleum engineers.
Right.
But I think what we're really thinking about, I mean, and these are being widely, seriously discussed, is one option is to become a nuclear power, which is, you know, well within our capacities to do. But the other is a strategy much like Finland uses with Russia, which is called whole society defense. And I think something like that is probably coming to Canada, if in effect a kind of national service or conscription where, I mean, Finland knows that if Russia comes for them, they will not be able to withstand it indefinitely, but they can make it clear to Russia that it will be so painful for them to conquer Finland that it's not worth it. And I think those are really options that are both very much on the table, both very much being discussed here. So we're not powerless at all. It would be asymmetrical, but, you know, asymmetrical warfare does not tend to work out well for the country that is the Goliath in the David and Goliath scenario.
Have gun sales changed in Canada as a result?
No, Canada's a very gun-heavy country. I think we're compared to you, of course, we're nothing. But, you know, we have a lot of wide open spaces. I mean, half my uncles would own guns here, right? I mean, there's lots of hunting here. There's lots of people who live in remote areas. Even people who have acreages probably have a .22. So we're already a very armed society.
So what most worries you about Trump and his second administration in general?
Boy, you asked me to pick one. Yeah, that's a hard. That's a hard one.
Give me your top three or top 100.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's just the chaos, right? Like, it's the flood the zone strategy. It's just the unreliability and the sort of slapdash nature of everything. You literally just don't know what's going to happen next week. I mean, that in the broadest sense is the real danger. Because, you know, it seems from here that America is a bus going off the cliff, and we're pretty attached to that bus. I mean, you know, everyone in here has family in the United States. I've lived and worked in the United States. Almost everyone I know has. I mean, as I said, I write for all these American publications. We're pretty intertwined, right? Like, we're intertwined countries. And so this loss is very painful. And the danger that is imminent in it is because of these sort of the broader sense of incipient chaos from emerging from America. I understand that's not a very satisfying answer because it's so vague. But on the other hand, it's the fact that you don't know what's coming next week that's the really scary part, if you know what I mean.
So, I mean, I obviously agree with your view of Trump and Trumpism, and we'll get into just how hyperpartisan and fragmented our political landscape is over here in America. But
yeah.
I mean, what would you say to someone who doesn't see any of this? I mean, I think we have witnessed just immense brand damage being done to America in the last 10 months. It's just a colossal act of vandalism from my point of view.
Yeah.
And I would think you would share that. But as an outsider, as someone who's principally viewing this from across the border, how would you explain this to someone in America? I mean, it's probably half of American society still at this point. Who simply doesn't see it this way. I mean, they just see a lot of strength. I mean, what Trump is doing is he's forcing our European allies to shoulder their fair share of defense costs. So there was a massive free rider problem that he solved. He's brought peace or a precursor to peace to the Middle East. He's solved a bunch of other wars that no one can probably name, but he's claimed credit for. There's just a lot of strength and cutting through red tape and norm busting where the norms were preventing progress. All of this tariff juggling is just a way of resetting everyone's expectations in a way that will redound to the advantage of our country in the end. And now everyone knows to really take us seriously. I mean, finally, the sheriff's in town, and rather than an octogenarian who can't utter complete sentences, we have a strong near octogenarian who speaks in a very persuasive word salad. And this is fantastic. We're born again as a strong country. How is it that you can't see that strength for what it is?
Well, I guess the question that I see, you know, the Canadian point of view would be to the side of that in a certain sense. I mean, because to me, power in the 21st century is a combination of things. One, it's alliance networks and trade networks, right? That is the scope of your trade networks is the size of your power. That's why Europe formed the European Union, to get more powerful. It's your scientific community and your engineering base, which was, until a year ago, you know, everyone was trying to get a tiny fragment of what America possessed in that space. And you're just throwing those people to the world for free, basically. And also, I wouldn't underrate soft power as well. Like, I think the idea of America as an aspirational place, an ideal, is totally shattered. But, you know, like, I don't think I need to explain that to Americans. I mean, like, there are a large number of Republicans who believe that the 2020 election was stolen. This is truly the collapse of the United States is apparent to people on both sides. And I mean, I think when you look at American polling, you see people consistently who are under the impression that their country is in collapse. Like, I certainly would never lecture Americans on the subject because I think they know all too well what's happening to them. And I don't think it's left and right that knows what's happening to them. They both have figured out that this system is breaking and the constitutional order is falling apart. And everything that sustained America from that constitutional order is collapsing, right? And so that is apparent. It's just everyone is happy when their side is winning for now. But, you know, the other side always comes in. And then you're under the impression that the breakdown is total. So I don't think Americans need a lot of convincing that they're in a country that is not stable. I think that is very apparent to people on both sides. Hmm. And I would also add that, you know, the case I make in the book, and which I really do believe, is that Trump is really just a symptom, right? And you can get infuriated by him, and he does damage in himself, but what he represents properly understood is a breakdown in trust in institutions, a breakdown in, you know, the American dream of your children doing better than you, and a lot of other breakdowns. Yeah. So, I mean, I think blaming Trump is just a mug's game. That's not clarity of vision to me.
Okay, we'll get into the details here. First, when did you write the book? It was published in 2022. I forget when in the year, but when were you actually writing it?
It was based on a magazine article I wrote in 2018. So that was the first thing I wrote called The Next Civil War came out in 2018. None of my editors then believed it was, they thought it was all alarmist. And then, of course, my publisher, he thought it was alarmist. And then I've been called alarmist the entire publication history of it. But yeah, I worked on it from 2018 pretty much through 2021.
And how did you go about researching it? First, describe what you do in the book. I mean, you basically, in a semi-fictional way, it's a nonfiction book, but they're fictional vignettes where you present a plausible case for how a civil war in the 21st century in America would unfold.
I mean, you know, just to be clear, like what the strength of the book is really the models. I mean, and what I wanted to do was take these political models of various things, agricultural models, political decline in faith in the legal system models, you know, the models from Prio about civil war, because the United States is a textbook case of a country headed for civil war. Take those models and synthesize them and then present sort of projections of what that might look like. All the while being very clear that like no one knows what the future brings. Some models are stronger than others. All models are wrong. Some models are interesting. And also, you know, I crossed America multiple times talking to white power groups and far left groups and, you know, ordinary people being torn up by this. So I interviewed about 200 people for the book, and then I brought those insights together into one place and then provided sort of projections just to give flesh to the bones, right? Because the models can be a bit dry if you're just trying to read them.
You must have seen Alice Garland's film Civil War.
Yes, yeah.
Well, what did you think of that in terms of how it depicts the kind of the mechanics and unraveling culture of the situation?
Look, it's a very entertaining film. I think it was a necessary film for its time. But, you know, for one thing, as a journalist who knows a lot of like war reporters, you probably know them too. That's not really what war reporters are like, that character. But also, you know, the Civil War, when I talk to the experts on it, what they don't imagine is like, you know, I mean, in his film, Texas and California are on the same side fighting the federal government. I mean, if Texas and California could agree on something,
we wouldn't have a problem.
Be having this conversation, right? Like you wouldn't be having me on your show. Like, and also I think the nature of the Civil War that I'm talking about certainly isn't pitted armies against each other, like blue coats versus gray coats in some kind of battle. Like it's the rise of political violence where it explodes. And then, I mean, what really becomes dangerous is that the attempt to suppress the political violence itself becomes a cause of the political violence. And this is what has happened in all the major civil wars from Algeria, Vietnam, and many, many others, Iraq, Syria, and so on. So like the vision of civil war in my book is really about expanded political violence. It's not, you know, state against state or anything like that.
That's a hang up that some people have with the phrase civil war. They're imagining
it makes better it makes better movie. Yeah, right. Yeah, but that's not the way these things actually work.
Well, the film is really must be seen for at least one scene with the scene with Jesse Plemons where he's wearing those red kids glasses.
Incredible.
And anytime a guy with a AR-15 is digging a mass grave and he's wearing kids dime store glasses, you know that civilization has properly unraveled.
Well, I'm sure that I know also, like having talked to snipers and in various situations, that those scenes are very close. Yeah, like, that's like those scenes are not wrong.
Right.
I just think the political framework is wrong, but you know, emotionally correct at a lot of points of that movie.
So you did. You said 200 Around 200 interviews for
the
book?
Yeah, around that. I mean, around that. If you include all the people I talked to just on the street and stuff, right. Yeah.
But talking to military experts and yeah. people who've kind of modeled this out?
Yeah, and people who, I tried in the military stuff. I mean, I talked to quite a few military people. I tried to get, you know, multiple perspectives on Civil War because, you know, America's been fighting these, you know, partisan conflicts for, you know, 80 years, and there's a lot of expertise. I mean, the vast bulk of that opinion is don't ever start one.
Mm.
But there, I wanted to get different perspectives on it, and I did.
So we'll talk about the problem with counterinsurgency and how that creates the chaos it's trying to solve. But what are the risk factors as you view them for civil war in America?
Well, I mean, what the typical model, like the model that I got from Prio, is that civil wars tend to be a complex cascading system. So that means that it's not any one thing. What it is it's the factors that combine into each other. And some of them are very deep. Environmental considerations play a surprisingly big role. A country becoming a minority-majority country. So like that was one of the biggest bellwethers of civil war. Right. And that's not we know that that's coming in America. Like white people are about to be, by 2040, or will be a minority-majority. They will no longer be over 50% of the country. Wherever that happens in the world, there's political violence. And that's not a white people thing. That happens in India. It happens in Africa. It happens everywhere.
Let's linger on that point because this is obviously politically toxic left of center. I mean, there's this mantra, diversity is our strength, which said in scare quotes makes you sound like a white supremacist. Like, oh yeah, diversity is really our strength. Oh, tell me about it. But this seems to be a pattern wherein a truly pluralistic open society is vulnerable to this negative attractor on the landscape, which is diversity does actually undermine social trust. And this is Robert Putnam's argument.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I say this as I am a multiculturalist to my fingertips, like to my essence. I was raised in a multicultural society. That's the only society I could live in. But there's no question that it does undermine social trust and that it has causes to that. But I mean, what is more interesting, there's a really fascinating study out of India where, you know, the Muslims are sort of the lower caste in India and Hindus are higher. And when Muslims get higher spending power in relation to Hindus, so not higher, but just coming up to equality, that's, you can literally chart the violence on that nature. So on that reality. So it's not Hindus losing. It's just losing in relation to a sort of underclass, right? And this is a very horrific aspect of human nature that, as I said, is not, you know, that's not some problem with just white Americans. You know, American diversity, it is one of the most diverse countries in the world, I think by far. Like, I think it is the most diverse country in the world by far, right? Like, other countries talk about it. America actually lives it in a way that is unique, frankly. And a lot of the American strengths is a lot of its economic strengths, a lot of its political strengths, a lot of its aspirational strengths, its soft power strengths have come from that. But, you know, that's one element of this as well. The other one is just the decline in trust in institutions that's been on course since about 1980, right? And which is just a continuous line, and it's all institutions. It's the church, it's the media, it's government, it's the Boy Scouts, it's everything. And so that's also, Putnam talked about that a lot, right? So you have this decline in social trust, then you also have inequality at both horizontal and vertical inequality at these just simply unbelievable levels. I mean, much higher than America in 1776, right? So you have economic stressors, you have political stressors, you have social stressors. You know, they're what the CIA calls a threat multiplier, right? And America has a lot of threat multipliers at the time. As I said, it's not one thing. It's just all of them folding in on each other. Add to that, I mean, I didn't even mention hyperpartisanship.
Yeah.
Right? Which is sort of the tip of the spear, if you will. Mm-hmm. But that too is, you know, that's a very classic precursor to civil war.
Yeah, that's the one that is truly visible, I think, to everyone. I mean, obviously, there's wealth inequality and other of these factors, but those can be kind of out of sight and out of mind to many people much of the time. What you really can't ignore, and certainly if you have any online life and are consuming the stream of current events on any level, you can't ignore this hyper-partisanship, which seems to have achieved a new level. I mean, there's just frank hatred of the other happening in our society politically. And there's just one norm violation after another in the sense of there's no expectation of fairness or collegiality at the level of politics anymore. It's simply, if you can do something and get away with it, then you're going to do it now, lest it be done to you the next time around. So there's a kind of a tit-for-tat sort of political war happening here, which is seems genuinely new. I mean, I'm sure we've had periods of it in the past that people can recall or reference, but
it's pretty new since about 1876. Like the last time it was this bad was, you're really going into the pre-modern era to get hyper-partisanship levels like you have now, genuinely. Like there was not this level of hyper-partisanship during the Great Depression, for instance.
Right. And also trust in institutions was, I mean, even when, you know, I think you make this point in your book, when Kennedy was shot and MLK was shot, and those were happening in contexts where trust in institutions was much, much higher. And it was even higher after Watergate in Vietnam. I mean, it had fallen to like 33%, but now we're down to like 22% of people who would say that the government generally acts in the best interest of the population, or that it can count upon to do the right thing, et cetera. Or the media generally prints facts.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with this piece of hyperpartisanship and the extreme left and the extreme right. How do you view the two extremes differently? I mean, if the pathology of the extreme right versus the pathology of the extreme left, I think I know which worries you more, but how do you weight them and characterize them?
Well, I mean, just to be clear, like one of these sides is threatening to conquer my country, right? Yeah. So let's just put that on the table and say, like, there's very clearly one of these sides that worries me most. But, you know, I mean, the reason I wrote this book is that I wanted to stop being in a state of moral outrage all the time and start to try and figure out what is going on. And I think the process that is going on, the phrase the sociologists use is complementary radicalization. To me, it's the key concept, because what it does, and of course, social media is a part of this as well.
Yeah.
But as the left gets more insane, and we went through a period of left-wing insanity in about 2020, the right responds by getting more insane. And the period of right-wing insanity that we're in right now will then generate a further kind of left-wing insanity. And meanwhile, what happens in the middle is that all questions of policy just get removed from political life. Even if you look at these No Kings protests, right, these are aesthetic acts. These are acts of an aesthetics. They're not really part of a politics, right? They're not really part of a, like, let's shape policy, which, you know, if you wanted to ask the big difference between Canada and America, I mean, in its terms of its politics, it's that Canadian politicians talk about policy. Like, Americans talk about policy in this very vague way. Like, there's not actual plans to do things. So what I see, rather than judging one side or the other, I think it's really important to say, what are the processes underway here? Why have both sides of the political equation been incentivized to be insane? And what can we do to de-incentivize them from being insane? Because there's lots that can be done to de-incentivize hyper-partisanship, lots, right? And so I'm not really in the judging business, right? Like, that interests me a lot less than trying to understand the underlying motivations and the underlying systems that hold on to this. But, you know, both of these groups have been driven to their extreme positions. And those positions are in direct countervalence to the interests of the American people, I would add, right? And very clearly they are.
So what can be done to de-radicalize the
extreme? I mean, there's, like, start with open primaries, right? Yep. Like, open primaries, like when they did that in Alaska, they got common sense back in politics in about 5 minutes. I mean, open primaries are a really basic solution to this, because essentially, rather than have only people who are members of a party vote on who the candidate is, you have the whole, you know, Democrat and Republicans both capable of voting on it. And that means that rather than having to win over a fringe of your own base to be the nominee and then fight partisan warfare, you have to appeal to sort of a broad middle. And the effects of it are pretty shockingly amazing, I would say. I mean, every time it's actually been tried, it actually removes fringe elements pretty rapidly. But it's an annoyance for the political class. You know, they don't have guarantees. I mean, that's the thing about gerrymandering that we're seeing right now, which is, you know, very, very destructive of the American body politic, no matter who does it, is that Now you don't have people who have to fight, who have to explain ideas to people. You just have people who have to navigate a political machinery to get a position that is guaranteed. Mm. And that's, you know, that to me is not really functioning democracy. The problem is that everyone is incentivized to be, like, the political careers of people, of individuals, are all harmed by that, right? Mm. They're all damaged by that. So you actually have a world where to be successful in politics, you have to ignore what is best for the country. And that's where you start to get to concepts like a constitutional convention and like a proper reevaluation of the basic political structures of the country, which I think is inevitable on either level. And I know how insane and grandiloquent that sounds, but I really don't really understand another path forward here.
It sounds insane and quixotic just from the point of view of it being unlikely to come to pass. But if you could wave a magic wand and make it available as a mechanism, when you look at the maniacs and lunatics and weirdos who would have a hand in that discussion at the moment, it's like it's hard to know when you want to press play on that right. on those deliberations, because you want Stephen Miller and Laura Loomer and Steve Bannon, and I mean, are those the minds, the sober minds you want rewriting the Constitution?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, exactly. And this is why it's like, this is why these things spiral out of control, right? Because it's exactly like when you incentivize this kind of lunacy, it becomes a self-perpetuating and self-generating reality. That's why the book is called The Next Civil War and not, you know, here's what to do to solve your problems.
Right.
Like it's right. like, because like these patterns tend to expand.
So since you wrote the book, we've had a fair number of political assassinations and attempted assassinations.
Yeah.
The attempts on Trump's life, the murder of Charlie Kirk.
Right.
First, just give me your impression of those events and how our political culture responded to them. But I'm wondering if the aftermath of any of those events increased your hope or increased your concern about the fate of the American politics.
Well, the experts got it right. Like the people that I spoke to, they all called it right. Like they knew what was going to happen when this happened.
Mm.
I would say the approval of Charlie Kirk's murder, and I mean, not that, like, just the widespread, the fact that there was any kind of approval of that whatsoever from the left was a little surprising to me, because, you know, when I researched the book, certainly right-wing political murder dwarfed left-wing political murder, right? I mean, yeah. I think the final stat I had was like 54% was right-wing murder and 4% was left-wing murder. I think it went up slightly the next year to like 52% versus 10%. Don't quote me on that. Mm. But I wonder this year if the left-wing political violence will be much more comparable to the right-wing political violence. But, you know, I mean, it is exactly what the experts said. It's like when you're in these hyper-partisanship environments and you feel like your politics no longer gives access to any kind of choice for people, like you're not in control of your political system, violence becomes a legitimate means of doing business. And that's when things get really out of control, right? When the feeling is that violence is the only way to have your voice heard. And I think that has become much more prominent this year than it has ever been to me.
Yeah, one thing was markedly asymmetrical about the political hysteria on both sides. I mean, on the left, you did have this, I guess, Gen Z outpouring of support for political assassination as measured by some hundreds or even thousands of TikTok videos.
Yeah.
But the people in those videos represented no one really other than themselves and their weird subcultures. They certainly didn't represent the Democratic Party or the establishment in any sense. And there was no mainstream Democratic figure with any kind of real platform who said anything other, who expressed anything other than their horror over Kirk's murder. Whereas
sure.
on the right, we had everyone from the president on down, including Elon Musk and all of their enablers and concubines, that they basically treated this as the first shot fired in a civil war, and they were just heaping gasoline upon these embers, seemingly with just utter disregard for the possible consequences. I mean, Elon jumped on Twitter within 5 minutes before Kirk had even been declared dead, and certainly before the shooter had been caught, And he tweeted to 225 million people that the left is the party of murder. Right. And then he said, well, then he followed up with, if they won't leave us in peace, there's nothing to do but fight or die. This is him messaging at the widest possible scale to an increasingly combustible society that basically violence is unavoidable and the Democratic Party is culpable for murder and is organized around a cult of trans activists with sniper rifles.
Right. Well, look, I mean, I don't want to do both sides-ism. Mm. Like, I really don't. And I think most of the time I avoided that in the book. Like, but the fact that there is at all a tolerance for left-wing violence is pretty new.
Yeah.
Like, like that's a real development, right? Because the right wing's been violent for a long time, right? Like, I mean, certainly if you include things like sovereign citizens and the various far right groups, militia groups, and so on, they've had an incendiary taste for political violence at all. But, you know, I mean, you ask me what can be done about it. Like, it's very hard to do things when people want violence, right? When they have this like weird taste for it, they're developing this real taste for dehumanization. And I think that's coming to everyone.
How rightward shifted is gun culture? I mean, I'm kind of on the periphery of gun culture myself because I've done a lot of training with firearms, but I've never been a part of the culture and the religion of the Second Amendment. But I have to think that when you're talking about the extremes of the right and the left, most, if not virtually all of the guns and the obsession with guns and the militia style training and the recruitment from military and law enforcement, all of that is right of center, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure that we're in a position now where the terms conservative and liberal mean a lot in the United States anymore. I mean, until 2 years ago, the idea that liberals were in favor of tariffs and conservatives were not in favor of tariffs, that's completely changed.
Yeah.
You have a Republican president who's actively purchasing stocks of companies. This is the very opposite of a free market ideology. Yeah. So I think in terms of policy, that's meaningless. And I think when you go to guns, or really any third rail political subject in the United States, the policy aspects of it, like if you dig down into the people who are actually thinking of policy and like what is right and what is left, they're in way more agreement than the extremists who are on either side. And that goes for guns, it goes for abortion. I mean, if you ask Americans, should people have to wait to get machine guns, they will almost all, like huge numbers will say yes. If you say to them, do you believe in restricting guns? A huge number of them will say no. So you're dealing with a moment where aesthetics has overwhelmed politics to a point where actual policy discussions of what could help the country, what is a reasonable compromise and solution to various problems is no longer even on the table. So you may as well scream at your neighbor.
But don't you see that the threat of really consequential kind of militia-style political violence is asymmetric here? I mean, with respect to right and left.
Like
if you told me that people were rioting in major cities and randomly burning buildings and looting Williams-Sonoma and other retail stores, I'm pretty sure I know who's doing that, and it's not the MAGA faithful with their AR-15s. That's a left-wing, very multicultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
If you're telling me that there's organized people in full camo with, all of whom have stockpiled thousands of rounds of ammo and they've all got AR-15s and sidearms, I'm not thinking that's by and large, a left-of-center problem. That is a right-of-center problem, however you want to relate it to conservatism or liberalism.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, because I attended so many of those, like prepper conventions and like gun shows in rural Oklahoma and places like this, these are like very small communities. They change their politics rapidly all the time, right? Like, I mean, I didn't even put in the book like a description of the far right in the United States, even though I met with figures from all of these militias and all of these groups, because they change so fast. I mean, you literally call a source 6 months later and he's like, oh, I'm not with them anymore. I'm with XYZ. I mean, I described it as in the book as a political smorgasbord. So you have like, tax denial, essentially, that you have sovereign citizenry, you have second gun amendments, you have white power people who are different from KKK people who are, and they move between them and they pick and choose as they like. But it's all very, it's like a hobby. Hmm. Like it's, you know, and also like, I mean, you know, as I often thought at these prepper conventions, like I would go to them and I would think, well, I don't know what the end of the world is going to look like, but I'm pretty sure you're going to have to be able to run a mile and no one here can do it, right? Like no one in this room can do it. So yes, I would say like, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, just to be clear. Like obviously militias and so on are right-wing coded, but I'm not sure they even fit into a political category that we would know. I mean, their definitions of freedom are fundamentally unrealizable. Like, you know, you would go and hear someone talk and they would say like, everyone is a slave in America. Why is everyone a slave in America? Well, if you pay property taxes and you don't pay your property taxes, the government can come and take your home. So it becomes like, well, if everyone who's ever paid property taxes is a slave, what kind of world do you think is going to exist in freedom? Also, you know, the left-wing stuff, like there are small groups. I wouldn't describe them as militias, but there are, and left-wing purchasers are the number one purchasers of guns. They were in 2023 and 2024, I think.
Oh, interesting.
Like more, yeah. Like they were, you know, the other side are kind of saturated, mm-hmm. but they're buying more guns. But there are certainly, I would say, radical groups on the left. They're not as gun focused.
Antifa,
Yeah, well, I mean, Antifa's a very, I mean, go and try and find a leader of Antifa to interview. Right. Like you're not talking to anyone. But groups like the Portland Chaz and like all those groups, they were much more organized, and they had aspirations to, you know, overthrow the prison system, for instance, right? Those are kind of the left wing groups, not comparable at all in their capacity for violence, but similarly eager for the breakdown of the government.
Yeah, you describe, I mean, this smorgasbord of weird convictions and kind of just, it's a many-sided object, you know, all organized around a distrust of elites and institutions, if it had a kind of a single through line, I guess. But I mean, one thing you say in the book is that its very incoherence is a kind of strength. I mean, it need not even pretend to logical consistency. It's just, it kind of has the structure of many conspiracy theories. I mean, what conspiracy theories are built upon not even having necessarily a coherent thesis about what happened counterfactually to the mainstream narrative. It's just looking for anomalies everywhere and adding them up to just this sort of pornographic obsession with the feeling of doubt.
Yeah.
And so this distrust and doubt and this kind of anti-establishment, it's almost a religion of contrarianism that is born up left and right, but I think especially on the right.
Yeah, I mean, what I noticed after a while interviewing them is that something was valid because it was esoteric.
Right.
Right? Like it, the weirder it is, the more likely they are to believe it, right? So like, and that's why it spirals. Like you talk to a source one day and they believe something, and then 6 months later they're into lizard people having signed contracts with NASA, right? I mean, if you have this spirit of everything's being hidden from me, how do I uncover it? That's the sensation that they want. And as you say, that comes with a great alibi. Right. The alibi is, well, I'm never the one in power. Right. Which is why they'll all be able to walk away from Trump and everything that he does saying, well, I voted for him, but I didn't mean any of this. Mm. Right. Because it is very much an alibi. Like they're not, no one is taking responsibility for the actions of their own government. That's for sure.
Taking the flip side of that, I guess I have this question. Why are people right of center? I mean, just think of the MAGA faithful. I mean, that's not all of the landscape, yeah. Right of center, but everyone who's just been all in for Trump these years and is now getting more or less exactly what they want, one presumes.
Yeah.
Why are they still angry? I mean, they're basically running the table politically, and they will be doing it for presumably for 3 more years at least. I guess I half expected the victory around in the last election and the fast pace of kind of the juggernaut of change that has come rolling in with Trump and his enablers. I expected that to discharge some of the political and emotional pressure and, you know, animus coming from the right. I'm not sure I've detected any of the temperature coming down.
No, and that'll never happen. I mean, when you have a political goal that's fundamentally unrealizable, like you're never going to be satisfied. Like, I think the essence of the contradiction for me is that you have like this broad swath of people, and it really does incorporate everyone from like small government Reagan conservatives to, you know, the extremes of the far right, and I guess the sovereign citizen movement, if you want to include that, would be like the term is the anti-government patriot movement, right? So you have a group of people who believe that their patriotic duty and their love of their country is expressed in the limitation and destruction of their own government. You know, and America is a country founded by partisan warriors, right? Mm. It is a country founded by people who broke down a government and built a new one in its place. And so it is very essential to the country. And interestingly, a lot of countries that are founded by partisan warfare have the same problem, right? Like the Algeria has the same problem. And also has very similar gun laws and things of this nature. You have a fundamental contradiction that is being, they're thrusting themselves into with great vigor. And the farther they go into it, the more they realize the contradictory nature of it. So no, they'll only get angrier the more they achieve, right? Mm-hmm. The anger will only increase as they get what they want. And that's really why there is a great deal of danger. But, you know, I also think we're living in a discursive world. I don't know if that's too pretentious a name, when moral outrage really is the dominant currency, right, on left and right. And that is how you get attention. It is how you build coalitions even. And it's inherently unstable. Like, moral outrage is not a bedrock on which you can build a sensible society.
Yeah.
And that is increasingly just the currency of American discourse.
Hmm.
So I wouldn't discount that either.
So you mentioned social media. It really is the ever-present conduit of our lunacy and fragmentation. How do you view its contributions to this moment? And is there anything we can do to mitigate those contributions?
You know, it was funny. I planned when I wrote the book to write a whole chapter on social media and do a whole thing about social media. But then, you know, I started looking into it. And I'm like, well, Canada has higher social media engagement than the United States.
Mm.
Germany has higher social media engagement than the United States. So this can't be the reason. If I'm going to write this stuff, then I have to explain why countries that have all this social media stuff don't have this stuff happen. And also why countries where they have nothing but social media, like Ethiopia or Myanmar, like why they got to genocidal levels of violence and the United States hasn't.
Hmm.
So maybe I was like, okay, maybe I just don't understand this enough to write about it. I really wanted to write a book where I felt like I knew what I was talking about. You know, rare concept, but I really wanted to feel quite certain of the models that I was talking about, at least in their limits and strengths. Like, not that they're all strong, but that some are stronger than others. And I could explain to readers their strengths and weaknesses. And I think, you know, if I have any regrets about what I didn't put in the book, is that I really underrated the power of entertainment in American life. And I really didn't understand, and it's funny because I was the pop culture columnist for Esquire for almost 10 years, right? So I was I studied this stuff, you know, they gave me access to everything and everyone in it. And I just didn't see that it was going to overwhelm politics. I mean, when we look at the American political landscape today, what we're actually seeing is like ICE going on raids to get HD video to put on social media networks. Like, that's explicitly their goal. Like, they're saying that's their goal. And you have essentially a rule by social media stars. You have people who are talking heads on Fox running the military, right? And them calling in actual professionals, to like actual military professionals who are, you know, I've interviewed a lot of these people. These are about as serious as human beings get, the 800 people that he had in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to lecture them about how they need to present themselves better. So I think to say it's social media is actually probably insufficient. I mean, it's obviously correct, but it doesn't actually explain the force that is moving here, which is really the triumph of screens over everything else. And that what is screened in effect has become more powerful than any other reality, right?
Yeah.
You know, because if you look at the actual, what government officials are doing right now, they are not governing. No one seems to care. There's a government shutdown. There don't seem to be any plans to resume it in any reasonable framework. they're just doing TikToks all the time. Yeah. Like that's the actual business that they're in, right? So yeah, like the social media aspect of it is very hard to separate from that entertainment quotient and the fact that American politics has just been overwhelmed by its entertainment networks, really.
How would you add conspiracy culture to this picture?
Well, it's all of a piece, right? As we said, like the conspiracy theorists that I dealt with, you know, conspiracy theories emerge in these periods and in a lot of periods, like my PhD is on 17th century. There were also, before the prelude to the first civil war in England in 1644, there were a lot of conspiracy theories, a lot of emergences of new forms of explanations. And really it's the grasping to try and make a world sensible that increasingly seems nonsensical. And the way you do that, the way you cover your tracks is you say, well, it's evil. I don't want it to be this way, but it is. But to me, conspiracy theories are very much the grasping at some kind of background reality when we know that the truth is actually quite chaotic.
Mm. What do you think would have happened if one of those attempts on Trump's life had been successful?
I think the most controversial thing I say in the whole book is that if Trump were not elected in 2016, everything I say in it would be true. Like the destabilizing factors in the United States are quite outside of his physical existence, right? I think he is actively accelerating him. I think he is a catalyst to a lot of what we're seeing. But you know, all of the things we've talked about today, I mean, the biggest one is the decline of trust in the legal institutions, right? I mean, that is, we haven't even mentioned that. That's catastrophic, right? Like the lack of trust in the Supreme Court, the sense of courts as being spoils of partisan struggle.
Mm. But arguably no one is pushing harder on that door than Trump himself.
That's true. Yes, that's true. But you know, the people who prefigured him in 2015, they all did that too, right? And they would have been doing it without him. Like Newt Gingrich was here a long time before, and he saw everything in the nakedest of partisan terms, right? Pure spoils thinking. And so the deeper trends are really underway, and they are what is really worrying, not Trump or not Trump. Although Trump could be the end of the Republic, right? I mean, like, I'm not saying he's not significant in that way, but I'm just saying if Trump were to die tomorrow, it's not like the problems would go away. They wouldn't.
Yeah, no, I'm not thinking of the absence of Trump being especially helpful, although I do think it would be nice to move on from him in some orderly and legal way. But no, I'm thinking that because of how combustible our society appears, what would a successful political assassination have done to this powder keg had it occurred? I mean, I there are many people on the far left who, perhaps not in public but in private, were the new fans of political assassination, were saying, you know, it's too bad that shooter missed. But in my view, that is to disregard the significant likelihood that that political assassination would have just precipitated a level of social chaos coming from the right that it would have been basically the some version of your book.
Dear America, violence is not the answer. Like, I mean, violence leads to violence. Like if Trump had been assassinated, there would be a huge, much more, greater number of political violence. It is never the answer. It's not like there's examples from history where you're like, oh, well, that assassination really worked things out for that country. That's not how this works, right? Like, politics exists so that we don't have to kill each other. We can talk through our problems.
Yeah.
Once that goes, we're really in a chaotic realm. Like, we're in a chaotic realm, and no one is safe in that chaos. No one.
Why do you think trust in institutions has eroded as fully as it has?
You know, it's really the $64 million question. I mean, I'd actually like to know what you think of that because, you know, I studied this. I really asked a lot of people, and I knew that was the key question. Mm. Like, why has it been declining? And I will just tell you honestly, I don't have an answer. I mean, it seems to be a meta trend. It precedes the internet. It precedes the inequality levels. I mean, it's almost like a spiritual condition as far as I can tell, but that's useless. I mean, that's just not a helpful way to describe it. I mean, I'm just saying I don't know. I don't know where that comes from. I really don't.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I do think religiosity is an unhelpful component to the picture. I think as our first world societies increasingly secularize,
yeah,
and religion comes under the shadow and pressure of that, and there seem to be more zero-sum contests between scientific rationality and any policy that would be spun up on its basis and religious dogmatism, you get this grinding of the gears of tradition, yeah, and society. And I do think in America, for a long time, the so-called elite institutions have represented either an explicit or a tacit disavowal of some people's, many people's most cherished beliefs. And
yeah,
that becomes, at minimum, a lubricant for a kind of an anti-institutional focus.
The line I keep thinking about, I interviewed Richard Spencer, the mm-hmm, white nationalist, years ago. This would have been like 2016. And I asked him what he thought was going on. And he said something I've never forgotten, which is he said, the myth of the Second World War is dying. And it's like, what is that myth? That myth was a myth of collective sacrifice. Like, I think if you're asking me why is that those institutional, I mean, there's a different relationship to the self that we've developed since, and I mean, partly it's technological, but also it's just a kind of inward lookingness and a kind, because it also corresponds with this terrible rise in loneliness. I mean, certainly when you go to far right groups, I mean, you know, you see a lot of loneliness. I mean, the number one metric correlating to Trump voting on a county level is, are you in a state of physical pain? Right, like that was true in 2016. I actually don't know if that was true.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. That's
yeah,
very interesting.
I mean, you see it when you go into these places, right? Like, but so the book is much more practical than these. I wanted to keep the book in the realm of practical reality that I could explain. But to answer that question really requires some kind of almost prophecy, right? Almost some kind of like spirit, like an understanding of what happened to the human spirit over that period.
Well, I do think social media and the internet have been an accelerant for this breach of trust in institutions, just because it has just made it much harder to gatekeep. And I mean, granted, many of the gatekeepers have managed to discredit themselves. But when we lived in a world where there were three anchors on the nightly news channels, and you got one version of an account of reality, and more or less everyone trusted it, it was harder to be a conspiracy theorist and to have your pet theory about a cannibal, pedophile, satanic cult ring that runs the world justified by people you haven't met, but who seem to echo all of your concerns, at least online.
Yeah.
I mean, you just seem to, you really can stay as crazy as you want for as long as you want if you're just going to sit in front of a screen rather than have to meet these people in the real world.
Oh, yeah. And also, I think it's also the self-generating aspects of it. I mean, that was one thing that I really noticed is like talking to people over time is that it doesn't stay the same level of crazy. It has an accelerating mechanism.
Hmm.
Like you're always being thrust into the next extreme. And so it just generates a kind of forward momentum in people's intellectual lives that it's almost impossible to escape from.
So what would a civil war look like in the US, and what are the problems with counterinsurgency? We'd have this phrase,
right,
counterinsurgency, that has been applied not domestically, but to our misadventures rather often in the Middle East.
Yeah.
What are you picturing in America, and why is there a guaranteed failure mode in your opinion?
Well, I mean, sort of the best case scenario would be the troubles in Ireland, and the worst case scenario would be like Syria, just to posit those as extremes.
Right.
The problem is that, you know, I wanted to say very technical on the aspects of civil war. The Peace Research Institute of Oslo, the threshold is 1,000 combatant deaths a year. I'm not sure that's particularly meaningful in the United States because it's so much bigger than other countries and it's so much more diverse and it's so geographically diverse that even 1,000 deaths, I wouldn't necessarily even put that as a threshold of what we would call a civil war. But, you know, I would say that I think America has already, in a place that's comparable to the troubles in Ireland, or certainly comparable to the years of lead in Italy, where political violence has a real impact on political speech and corruption and the derogation of institutions is well underway. The nature of political violence means that—
Actually, Stephen, can you just cycle on that claim one more time?
Yeah.
Because I think most people will think, well, there's not that much political violence in America, and it hasn't really been very consequential. What are you thinking about there?
Well, it also depends on what you define as political violence, right? There's actually no institution that keeps records of political violence. You have to go to third parties because, you know, a sovereign citizen is stopped by the police, shoots the police. The sovereign citizen regards that as a political murder.
Mm-hmm.
The police regard that as just an insane person, right? Mm-hmm. So which category do you fit that into? I think even some school shootings have political dimensions to them that are, you know, could be classified kind of either way. The shooting of the CDC person, the Charlie Kirk assassination, the Luigi Mangione murder, is that political violence? I would fully qualify it as that, right? Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with, you know, already in 2018 and 2019, there were roughly like 60 or 70 political murders a year. Obviously, that's accelerated quite rapidly right now. I don't have the numbers for it because no one is providing them. And it's also unclear how the FBI will categorize these murders given their control by the Trump administration.
Yeah.
But America is already in a place where if we wake up to news of a major political act of violence tomorrow, no one will be surprised. Like this is now a regular part of life, you know? I mean, I was always amazed when I started interviewing people for the part about gun culture, and I'd met people in their 20s who'd been in not one, but two mass shootings.
Mm-hmm.
Like a mass shooting for them was not a once in a lifetime event. It was something that was part of their existence wherever they were. I think we're now entering a period where political violence is quite elaborate. And also, we're entering a phase that I think the more pressing point is that political violence has consequences. So the Charlie Kirk assassination, not only did it have these left-wing resonances, but the right used that as a tool to change policy and to get people fired. And they used it as a tool of cancellation, essentially. So you're in a place where political assassination is now a justification for actual policy decisions.
Mm.
That's when you're entering a period where political violence is properly a force in your society.
America, I would also add that one of the reasons why Trump wasn't impeached after January 6th was that there were many lawmakers who were frankly afraid to impeach him because of the prospect that the MAGA cult may come for them or their families.
So, yeah, and also the January 6th protesters, or whatever you want to describe them, they all consider themselves political prisoners, right? They sang the national anthem in prison, right? So from their point of view, they're already just combatants in a political struggle. So just to say that I think America has already entered a phase where political violence is quite a force in its society and its politics. And every case where that happens, it tends to spiral. And the really troubling thing is that I really don't see any evidence of anyone trying to stop it. Right. I don't see any evidence of anyone trying to calm the situation or retreat from these, you know, monstrosities.
Well, that was the asymmetry I thought I saw after Kirk's assassination, was that on the left, you know, certainly among prominent Democrats, everyone was saying political assassination is totally unacceptable. Let's pull back from the brink here. This shooter represents no one. Whereas on the right, you had people saying that they're trying to kill us. This is a civil war. We're going to destroy them. And you look at Stephen Miller's eulogy, which was completely unhinged at the Kirk Memorial, as were several others.
I guess to me, like the thing was the asymmetry used to be extreme, right? Like the asymmetry used to be like zero and one, essentially. Like now the asymmetry is softening. Like it's still asymmetrical. Don't get me wrong. But I am very curious to see what the political violence numbers from this year are, because I assume there'll be much more, like it used to be 50 to 1.
Right.
It's not that anymore. But the asymmetry persists. I mean, don't misunderstand me. Yeah.
So if there were an unraveling, a troubles-like unraveling or worse here, and the government was trying to knock it down by launching a proper counterinsurgency strategy, what's the dynamic there that seems doomed?
Well, basically by trying to give politics a space to operate, you can't have violence, right? To have meaningful elections, let's see what 2026 is like. You can't have a climate of violence. Like it doesn't function. And people don't regard those elections as legitimate. And that leads to more increases in violence and more sense that violence is the answer to political problems. To create that political space, you have to clamp down on society, right? And so that is what the surge in Iraq was, right? Where they essentially broke down Baghdad and other parts of Iraq into zones where it was very hard to move between them. And this created a lot less violence, which opened political space. But you're just crushing down the sentiment that's going to explode the moment you let it off, right? The moment you stop it, which is exactly what happened. And of course, we're dealing with America, who do not, like, you know, if you're trying to combat violence, the very first thing you do is say, register guns. Like, what is the reaction to that going to be? If you want, I mean, and that's like the most preliminary step. Like, never mind, like, breaking Boston into seven zones that require movement between them, which is, you know, what they did in several Iraqi cities. Like, how much tolerance for that do the American people have? I would say zero. I wouldn't want to be the person trying to impose that on the American people. So that's the essence of the problem, is that the more that you try to clamp down on the violence, the more violence you cause, right? Which is why the Taliban at the start of the Afghan war were 40,000 people, and now they're run the country, right? Because every time you try to suppress those 40,000 people, they just grow, right? So if that, you know, the various war game scenarios that I saw from military figures, which are what I base the book on, right? Like, what I base the first chapter of the book on, where they essentially gamed this out and saw what it would look like. You know, it's a no-win situation. But any counterinsurgency manual you read from any United States expert of all kinds, I mean, there are exceptions. Some people say it's necessary to very briefly to create these political spaces. But the biggest impression is, don't ever get involved in this game, because you cannot win. It doesn't matter how asymmetrical it is. It doesn't matter how dominant you are. You cannot win. And I think that's being tried on countries that are a whole lot more obedient to authority than the United States.
Well, the place you arrive in the book that will strike many people as more or less unthinkable, you nevertheless think about it, the prospect of secession and disunion of the United States. What, I mean, again, this seems just like dystopian fiction to most Americans' ears. How does this seem at all plausible to you?
I mean, when I put it in the book, like, the reason I put it in the book is because I went and talked to all these secessionists, and then I went and talked to all these constitutional law experts, and the constitutional law experts were unanimous. There was no, here's opinion A, here's opinion B, you triangulate. It was, there is no way to secede in the United States. I'm like, you know, I'm in Canada, my country almost broke up twice in my youth, right? Quebec almost left in 1984 and then 1995. And we have a whole mechanism for dealing with it, right? We have there's a whole process by which that could occur. The 14th Amendment fundamentally makes that impossible in the United States. However, and that's what I wrote in the book, it's basically impossible to do because of not only the legal status of the 14th Amendment, but also because of the UN. Things have changed. You know, I think the 14th Amendment, it could be meaningless in a year. Like it is being torn down by the Supreme Court so rapidly that redefinitions of it, and I mean, that is the fundamental tenet of citizenship in the United States, that anything is possible. I think also what we're seeing kind of practically, I don't actually see a lot of people writing about it, and I don't quite know why, is that you're seeing in effect a soft secession already, where you have like California and a bunch of other states essentially forming their own CDC, their own health authority that they are using as a de facto national institution. You know, the really interesting thing is that the states in America that are rich as hell, Trump is actively hurting the most, right? And like the state of Massachusetts, which did not have a single county vote for Trump in 2024, you know, that's one of the most successful societies in human history. Other than the manners, it's pretty much an ideal, prosperous society. Trump is really taking the boots to their educational dominance, which is the source of that prosperity. And I genuinely wonder how much longer they can take it. And the same with California, who's 27% of the federal budget, right? Like if California just decides to stop paying its taxes to the federal authority, you know, the states of Oklahoma and the states of the South, they will decline very rapidly. Right.
I think one figure, I forget if it was Louisiana or Alabama, one of those states received something like $7.80 for every dollar it pays into the treasury.
It's South Carolina. Yeah. South Carolina, like it's almost $8 for every $1 it puts in. I mean, California is so much richer than any other place on earth. It's $20,000 GDP per capita richer than New York State, which I think is number two, right? That if that went away, it would all fold like a house of cards, right? Like, I mean, and I think when you hear Pritzker talking the way he's talking, when you hear Newsom talking the way they're talking, the old constitutional orders are, they know they're fading, and that gives them options that they did not have before. So, you know, in the book, it's very much like, this is why this can't happen. But increasingly, why would California want to be part of this insanity? Especially since the very core of its prosperity is being eroded every week, right? And the core, it's being made weaker every week. And how much longer is it going to take that?
It is interesting. I noticed in the way you partitioned. I don't know where you got that map of the.
Oh, that was out of my head.
But you managed.
But I got it out of some psychological studies of like the psychological states. That there's personality traits between those four regions. But yeah, I mean, that's one model that I based it on. But it's not like that's world's most reliable model.
Yeah. Well, the one thing that was interesting about the parcellation there was that no one of those separate countries was landlocked. Everyone had access to the ocean, which seems necessary somehow.
Yeah.
But
they would all be incredibly prosperous, right?
Yeah. I'm sure California, or it was, I guess, Cascadia, right? It was California, yeah,
basically
Oregon,
Cascadia. Texas itself, I mean, Texas is, you know, one of the most successful economies in the world. It could, in effect, be a country tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right. And so would California. And I mean, from a Canadian point of view, that would be pretty much ideal for us.
Right.
To have four countries rather than one, four sane countries rather than one insane behemoth sounds like a pretty good deal to me.
Certainly better than being absorbed as the 51st state in the one insane behemoth.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. I really enjoyed the book, and you're a very fine writer too. So people should know that awaits them when they open that book.
Thanks very much, Sam. Really appreciate it.